Welcome to this session from a Sustainable Wine Roundtable Conference in the winery, Energy Use and Capturing CO2. Climate change, carbon emissions have been the focus of sustainability for a while now, largely driven by financial sector, national net zero targets, as well as the protests that we've seen by young people. So we all know that energy consumption produces emissions, but also fermentation has a byproduct of CO2. But the question is this something that we should be worried about, given that the emissions only occur for a few weeks in autumn, and after all, the wine industry in its totality only produces an estimated 0.01% of global CO2 emissions. On the energy side, of course, prices are at an all-time high, driven by the energy security issue. But so what should wineries consider when making decisions about energy efficiency? I'd like to welcome two out of our three panelists at the moment. Hopefully we will get a third one very shortly. Diana Snowden-Sais, who's a winemaker at Snowden Vineyards over in sunny California. And Felix Egerer, who's a viticulturalist with Unsworth Vineyards. And interestingly, he's currently involved with the design and execution of a new winery, so can bring us rather up to date with this sort of challenge of designing new versus refit. Diana, perhaps I could come to you first. And I know that this is a subject that you're passionate about, but have done some work on. What'd be really helpful is if you could give us a bit of a sort of set the scene regards to CO2 and capture, give us that sort of 101 on CO2 emissions in the winery and their capture.
Of course, I'm happy to, yes. And while I'm speaking to you this morning from California, where it's 6 a.m., I actually straddle California and Burgundy, and I also make wine at Domaine Dujac in Burgundy. And we just retrofitted our winery and made it as sustainable as possible, including the plumbing to capture fermentation from carbon dioxide emissions from fermentation.
Great. So we've got absolutely the right person. And thank you. Right. Thank you. I'd forgotten that it was so early where you are. So thank you for getting up especially early for this.
My pleasure. It's a subject indeed that I have been thinking about and studying for a very long time. It actually captured my imagination back when I was an undergrad at the University of Davis at Berkeley, and Roger Bolton has built some of the prototypes for carbon dioxide capture and has been very vocal about it and very helpful to me as well in my research. So I think first you have to set the context when I'm a winemaker, and obviously climate change I've seen its impacts both in Burgundy and in Napa, and it is clear to me that if we are going to be able to pass on this beautiful tradition to the next generation, we absolutely have to get our companies to zero emissions as fast as possible, because that's within our sphere of control. And when you evaluate the impact of a bottle of wine on the wine industry, you first want to look at the holistic whole, and it's called a life cycle analysis. And there are 26 criteria, one of which is greenhouse gas emissions, then water consumption and pollution and rare minerals that are mined. And it is, again, this 26 criteria, this three-dimensional ball to evaluate the sustainability of a product. Then if you take one slice, one perspective, one element, the greenhouse gas emissions, and then you do a carbon audit, that is where we are examining within this complicated dynamic system. We're going to look at carbon from grape to recycling or throwing away at the very end. And if you do a carbon audit, just looking at one piece of this gigantic, complicated problem, if you look at, of course, we're making wine, and that is one perspective, but another thing we're actually making is carbon. And so built in within the production of winemaking, there are several points where we can find opportunities for negative emissions. And you've had panels talking about regenerative farming. It's the first farming approach, which talks about storing carbon in your soils. And that is a gigantic opportunity for all of us who have X number of hectares in our control to have a negative drawdown of carbon dioxide. You probably could look at your land and find places where you can rewild, or perhaps you have forests which you can protect, an enormous negative emission. Your pruning cuttings, also carbon. There's ways that you can trap that carbon, biochar, or you can take it to a bioreactor and harvest and combust it and make electricity. Then if you move into the winery during fermentation, yeast are digesting sugar to carbon dioxide. And there it is right there, you know, one of our number one greenhouse gas in one place in the winery in a 1 month period. And so it is a conversation that is a tiny subset of a conversation called direct air capture, which you're going to see more and more of in the news, because we have waited so long to change the way we live and use energy, that if we don't get to zero emissions by 2030, we are going to miss the window for the 1.5 degree Celsius increase since the Industrial Revolution. And that window is not a political window, it is a physical barrier. And so I think it's really important when you are thinking about a carbon audit, whether or not, you know, because a carbon audit does not count a carbon dioxide capture from fermentation as a negative emission, because that is a biogenic carbon dioxide source rather than fossil fuel combustion. It's part of the carbon cycle. And in theory, I mean, the idea is that the equivalent surface area of vineyards will suck that carbon dioxide back in. So it is zero. And any efforts you make to capture that carbon dioxide is not counted as negative in your carbon dioxide emission. But meanwhile, the planet doesn't care what the source of the carbon dioxide is, whether it is biogenic or from fossil fuels. And so if you are actually trying to get one step further in negative emissions, it's a huge opportunity sitting right there in your winery every year. And carbon dioxide also, you know, stings your eyes, burns your throat, and we have fatalities every year. And so sucking that off to a centralized location and doing something with it also has an interesting safety dimension to it. And what you can do once you've captured carbon dioxide is kind of vast. Again, there are so many options, each of which have to be examined in a life cycle analysis. And looking at energy, looking at cost. Cost is not actually an interesting conversation at this point, because all of these are prototypes. It is brand new technology. It is expensive. It makes absolutely no sense. The only reason you would do it is because this is the future and it is an exciting opportunity for negative emissions. And if you do have the budget to do that, then you are moving this exciting industry forward. But it is absolutely just the cherry on the icing, on the cake, on the plate of a holistic approach to sustainability. And there are very interesting applications, because when you talk about carbon dioxide capture, usually the conversation is around steel or cement. Here, again, because this is a fermentation, we have really clean CO2. And one application that I've seen that I think is quite interesting is capturing the CO2 with the fruity esters and then bubbling that back into water to make a naturally flavored non-alcoholic fizzy drink. And because when you think about all of our carbonated beverages, that those CO2 molecules come from fossil fuels. And, you know, I am a biodynamic farmer. When you think about the memory of water and you apply that to carbon dioxide, think about the memory of the carbon dioxide bubble. It's a little bit disgusting to think that you are drinking fossil fuel byproducts. So that's just one example. There are many, many applications, each of which have their own energy requirements and potential within your production scale. So it really is, you know, I've done a 2-hour lecture on the applications of CO2 captured from fermentations. And we don't have the time to go into all of those details, but that information does exist.
That's great, Diana. Thank you for that. One thing I'd like to ask you is that at Chateau du Jac, where you said that you've implemented a capture, a couple of questions. Could you talk us through the kind of the decision-making process for that, the evaluation? You know, what were the dynamics there? Because that would probably be a microcosm of a lot of other businesses, a lot of other vineyards that are going through the same thing. And also, do you have a beneficial reuse of that captured CO2?
Okay, so for the moment, we had to rebuild our winery because it had become too small. And because we were starting from scratch, we decided, you know, we insulated it to the nine. We use all local products. It is insulated with Burgundian straw, et cetera, et cetera. And we decided that we put in place infrastructure for CO2 capture. Our first vintage was last year. We did not capture the carbon dioxide because at this point, the options that exist are really not that appealing. They are very heavy in terms of infrastructure and not actually sustainable. So I have put a pin in it. We are ready to go as soon as the industry is ready to go. And that day will come. But I put a pin in it and I have rediverted my sustainability time towards bottle reuse instead. But so we have the plumbing, all of the carbon dioxide is evacuated to one central location outside, and we have plenty of space outside to move in the machine that we eventually choose to capture carbon dioxide. But the problem is that, I mean, where I see this going long-term is plumbing underground of our viticultural areas to one central location where their full-time job is to harvest the CO2 and turn it into biofuel. The setups that exist right now are extremely labor intensive. And as I said, not yet actually sustainable because the molecules that are necessary have in themselves generated a lot of greenhouse gases. But once carbon dioxide capture is actually a closed loop, which is to say, so we need a precursor molecule called carbonate that reacts with CO2 to make bicarbonate. If that bicarbonate then goes off, is peeled off for biofuel, and they bring back the very same molecule of carbonate the next year, then it's sustainable. But for the moment, that doesn't exist. You make bicarbonate and then you sell it for cakes or toothpaste or whatever. But to get the original carbonate molecule, you will have heated up bicarbonate, so with a heat energy, and thrown a CO2 molecule into the atmosphere. And so that was the approach that we were seriously considering. But until there is that closed loop, we're not tackling it yet.
That's really interesting. Thank you for that. And I've sort of throw the thought out, perhaps if we can get back to it, is other than that efficient technology, what are the other things that need to change in order to enable this? But you think on that one, and we'll try and come back to that in later on as we go through. Thank you for that comprehensive introduction to it. Zhao, welcome. I just introduce you quickly. Zhao Barossa is sustainability coordinator at Wines of Alentejo in Portugal, an environmental engineer, and he has managed the sustainability program for around 10 years. So, Zhao, I think it'd probably be great if you could tell us a little bit about that sustainability program. And I know that then you will, I'm sure you'll tell us that it covers a broad range of sustainability issues. But perhaps you could then, once you've given that introduction, just tell us a little bit where you see carbon CO2 capture fit into your program.
Well, thanks, James. Thanks to the organization. Welcome to my fellow panelists of the afternoon. We didn't reinvent the wheel. We basically did what a lot of very interesting and very, state-of-the-art regions were doing around sustainability back 10 years ago, particularly Chile, California, Australia, New Zealand. And we basically, adapted what was best of all of these schemes, fleshed it and mixed it again and redistributed in a way that was adaptable to what we were doing in Alentejo. And we create our own scheme. It's not a rocket science. It goes around the several areas of intervention that we always talk about, from the soils to the water management, to biodiversity ecosystems, to the cell communities, social economics, regional development, packaging, materials, eco-design. So it's really the plethora of what you consider to be a kind of a life cycle analysis view of what sustainability should be in the industry. Carbon at the moment is not something that we directly look at in the sustainability program because it's so embedded in so many aspects of sustainability and the activities of farming and in the cellar that obviously, if you look to activities from an efficiency perspective on a natural resource savings view and on even on the financial optimization of resources and costs. Obviously, carbon inherently and directly and indirectly will always be addressed, and will always work towards reduction of that, on one hand, emission, obviously, on the other hand, capture, if you're looking, as Diana put it so well, when you look into regenerative agriculture, or even looking at energy efficiency, or even looking at carbon technology. Obviously, all of these will work by default in terms of reducing our own impacts with carbon. So that's on a more broad perspective. Yes, we look at it from that indirect perspective, but no, we don't have so far. In fact, we are now doing a review of contents. We are 10 years old, so it's time to review contents and adapt and become more updated and more inclusive in some aspects of our program. And so now, indeed, we will be looking at aspects more related with carbon footprint in one first hand, not necessarily in carbon mitigation, but first and foremost in the carbon footprint assessment part, but still that is a work in progress. But then, having said that, it's also true that, and we discussed this briefly yesterday, as you know, I have this very realistic view on the problem of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is obviously, as we all know, a world problem. And the wine industry is, if anything, a victim of the problem. We are not by any means responsible by the problem. I mean, we look at carbon emission distribution and we see that agriculture represents roughly 18% of world carbon emissions, of which half, a little bit more of half, is dairy farm, so cattle farm. And then we have less than 7%, which is agriculture, the rest of agricultural industry, of which wine roughly represents approximately 0.3% of emissions. And so it is an industry that, on the responsibility aspect, is indeed not, it's negligible almost, the responsibility that we have on the big picture scenario. Having said that, we also all know that the vineyard is the canary in the coal mine for climate change. And so we are the first ones to feel it. And that's why there is a sustainable wine roundtable. That's why there are more than a dozen sustainability programs all over the world. That's why so many companies make so much effort in so many different areas to indeed try to bear in mind, minimize and adapt to climate change. It's not about tackling, because our industry cannot tackle climate change. We are too little to tackle whatever in terms of climate change. What we need to do indeed is to adapt to it. And so when you look to this, at least from this perspective of adaptation to climate change, I think the big buzzword is resilience in regeneration. And so, you know, obviously, and again, I don't get me wrong, everything that Diana said, I vouch and I subscribe. I just believe that if you have to choose where you're going to put your money, where you're going to put your investments in terms of strategy regarding your vineyards or your whole business, it's probably more fair to invest in, you know, cover cropping and buffer zones, in regeneration of water lines, in ecological corridors, in recovering your soils and recovering organic matter in your soils, the microbiome of your soil, because the soil is the skin, right? And all comes from the soil. And currently we've been very naughty in the way we've been treating our soils. And so it is definitely the most important thing in every agriculture, in every life form of the planet, to care and cater for the soil. And so if we go, okay, I can invest in a really nice technology to mitigate my emissions from fermentation, fair enough, if you are able to, go for it. But you can also get that money, you know, and help regenerate some part of a vineyard that will definitely help you when you face that, you know, heat wave, or you face that water crisis because it hasn't rained in 3 months, or because your soil is totally eroded and you have hardly any organic matter in it. And so, yes, obviously carbon is important. Yes, obviously carbon has brought us to where we are today in terms of this massive problem. And I'm in Alentejo here. Today is the 3rd of May and it's 30 degrees and it should be 22, okay? And it has rained since January. So that's a massive problem. But Again, if you have a fairly alive soil with all of your microbes and all of your little insects and small vertebrates, you can create the capacity to retain your water and have a humid soil that will for sure help you to endure a drought period. Maybe it won't help you to endure 5 years of drought, but for sure 1 to 2 years, that will for sure help you. And at the end of the day, we're here to produce great grapes, to produce awesome wines. And so it all starts there. And again, that's why I really believe that carbon is important, yes, but more important is to build this resilience in your system that by default, and this is the beauty of it, also helps with carbon, because every single plant or any single thing with I'm lacking the word, the green thing that makes photosynthesis. I'm lacking. Anyhow, any living being that makes photosynthesis will capture.
Chlorophyll, sorry.
Exactly. Thank you very much, Diana. Every single being that makes photosynthesis captures carbon dioxide. And so we're naturally a sink of carbon dioxide. So what we need to do is boost that, and at the same time cater for the needs of water and the needs of evapotranspiration and the needs of humidity and cooling. Obviously with the carbon also as an eventual target, but as I said, if you look at the big numbers, it doesn't seem to me to be the most, if we were all talking here in the sustainable transport alliance or in the sustainable building alliance, fair enough, we should be definitely looking at these issues, but no, we're in agriculture, and we're the least impact of agriculture. If you go to the World Data website from Oxford University, you'll see the carbon emissions from the whole chain in agriculture, and you will see that wine only loses to, I believe, I don't know, it's some dry fruit, almonds or whatever, in terms of carbon emissions. Everything else has double and triple and five times more emissions than wine has. So then, having said that, and just to finish, obviously, as we look at efficiency, particularly in energy, we by then default look at reduction in emissions. That is a no-brainer. At the same time, we strongly promote the use of renewable energies. Portugal is, after Greece, the country in Europe with more hours of sun per year, and Alentejo in particular, in the Alentejo scenario, in the Portuguese scenario, is the region with more hours of sun. And so obviously it's a no-brainer. We have lots of examples of producers that make investments that get paid, return of investment of 3 to 5 years. And then from that point on, it's free energy. But we also need to remember that we have a seasonal industry that has a graph that goes like this, being this peak in the harvest. And you don't produce energy in that same demand need. And so obviously technology needs to also mature a little bit more. We need batteries to save this energy that we produce to then be used. In fact, if you look at what the scenarios, well, which are less and less unfortunately scenarios, but what the future seems to be, particularly in hot weather countries, is late and night harvests. And for you to have a late night harvest, you need energy. But if you're looking at sun to feed you that energy, you can't do it at night. So you need the batteries. Without the batteries, you can't have store the energy to use it at night. And so obviously this all has a bit of a catch-22 approach, and at the same time, a drive to boost technology to increase in its development and to obviously come to the need of the industry, in this case, the wine industry.
Joe, I think you've illustrated very clearly there the complexity of sustainability and that complete ecosystem of issues and challenges that we have. Thank you for that. I've got a question. I'll come back to you hopefully if we've got time. But Felix, you've been sitting there very patiently, and I'd like to bring you in now. And really, given what we've heard from Diana and Joe, tell us a bit about the way that you've sort of looked at carbon, looked at energy in the design of the new vineyard. But perhaps just give us a little intro about Unsworth and what you're doing there before we start.
Yeah, thanks, James. sucking everything up here like a sponge. So much information, really, really good. So Unsworth, we're located somewhere between the 49th, 50th parallel on Vancouver Island off the west coast of British Columbia, Canada. I think we're about 2.5 kilometers from an actual ocean beach. So very different context than Napa, Burgundy, Ontario. But nevertheless, also witnessing all the changes that everyone else in wine regions is witnessing. We're coming into that sweet zone where we now can reliably grow and make red wine every season and don't have to hope for an extra hot and sunny season like it used to be, and maybe make Pinot 3 out of 10 vintages. Now it's very much every year, and the plantings are shifting from kind of experimental vinifera plantings and aromatic whites to your classic Pinot, Chard, Gamay, and just an industry that's very much growing. And Unsworth, we're right now are a size of 15 acres, and we're purchased as a company by the Jackson family, by members of the Jackson family 3 years ago now in 2020. And they have since decided to grow the business. That includes new vineyards, that includes a new winery building, and that we're going through the design process of that right now. And asking us all these questions that came up now, because we have a blank canvas to work with. And the question is, what do we do? How do you do it the best we can? Because this is a huge investment, much like Dujac's redevelopment. It's going to be there for a while at that size. And we're going to try to get it as up-to-date and perfect as we can, but also thinking about obviously what we do, how much, what the return is on that investment. And in a context that is British Columbia, coastal British Columbia, things are very different. We have long winters, lots of precipitation, 40 inches on average, so about 1,000 millimeters, just over that. Shifting, it's still mainly in winter, but that time is condensing where it does rain a lot and where it is cloudy a lot. Yes, the Pacific Northwest is kind of known or has this reputation for being gloomy all through winter, and it really does drizzle. It's gray. The sun comes out every so often. And then now I'm looking outside. It's May, and yesterday we were just, it was like 26 degrees. All of a sudden, within 2 weeks, everything just shifted. And now things are going nuts and everything is growing because there's water in the soil and the soil is clay. So everything is just going crazy, which is good from a farming perspective, which is what I mainly spend my time on, because I'm growing grass before I'm growing vines, and I'm using all my land and not just the 1 foot up in the air vertical space that my canopy eventually is going to be to draw down carbon and to cycle through it. And so when we're thinking about capturing the carbon, but as mentioned already, so what do we do with it? How do we do it? What are the different technologies? Yesterday in the pre-meeting, I mentioned that as a viticulturist, I would prefer a system that takes the carbon, sequesters in whatever way possible that makes sense. So I can then take that product and return it to the vineyard it came from. Ideally, obviously, we're not going to be able to match that one-to-one, but at least put it back on the land that it was drawn down into and that it was cycled through. There are systems that are interesting. One that has not really been mentioned yet is like something that a brewery or breweries have been doing, and it's happening on a smaller scale, a continuous bioreactor, essentially growing algae by bubbling the CO2 through. And then in my head, it would be nice to harvest that algae, compost it, or feed it to livestock and get it back out on your land. But as Diana mentioned earlier, everything is very experimental. We're quite remote. Even though we're just a couple hours ferry ride from Vancouver, being on an island, everything has to come here on boats. And we don't have tech companies readily at hand that we can just summon in and they'll come and hang out and develop it with us. We are trying, and we're getting input from all over the world. Having a large parent company helps with that, obviously, but it is the questions of what is the return on it? Because we do have to store the carbon or massively oversize a system to really only work for 6 weeks. And that takes up real estate in the winery that we then have to climate control, do all these things to, that maybe we can just shrink the footprint, not have that, offset costs that way and carbon emissions. And we're not at a point where I don't even know if we can do it. I'm like playing out all those numbers to see how it adds up. I'm pretty sure it would be heavily swayed towards the just leave it be and shrink your footprint as far as like a lifetime analysis. And just working with those intricacies, it's a tricky one, as I'm sure people have realized in this conversation. Like, what do you do? How much do you have to do? Why do you do it? Because it really is. It's like there's so many other things that we can do before that, before we even get to that point of fermentation, CO2 capture, that have a far greater impact. If I manage to have my vineyards that are now 60 acres green all season long as much as I can, how much CO2 do I draw more CO2 down? Now, if I run animals over it, do I draw even more down, and do I make it even more stable in the ground as through manure and humification, versus do I bubble it through a tank and then have algae that I put in my compost pile, which again, then I have to turn using a tractor or some other equipment that uses, at this point, diesel. It's an interesting game. It tickles my fancy as even as a viticulturist to think about those numbers and challenges. And from an energy perspective, especially we talked about yesterday, that the form of energy differs depending on your context. So Diana's energy in California or in Burgundy will come from a different source than the energy that powers vineyards and wineries in Alentejo. Than compared to what we are here in BC, we're exclusively almost run on hydro, I think, at this point. And those infrastructures are in. How much more do we have to do if we add the wine industry's favorite building accessory, solar panels? Is that something that we have to do? Does it really do anything for us if 6 months out of the year it's too dark? For them to really work, we can't store the energy. We already have fairly clean energy. How much more do we have to do? And while I do agree with all the points that we are very small, we don't have a huge impact, but we are very visible and talked about worldwide. Or maybe it just seems to us that way because we're in this industry and we move in these circles all the time. If you look at it, a grand scheme, is it even talked about that much just because there's one article in the newspaper every now and then? I'm pretty sure there's more on, I don't know, defense production.
I think that's a really good point, Felix, about is it talked about? Because, carbon emissions and climate change, of course, are the most talked about subjects in sustainability in the big picture. That is the singularly most pressing issue that we're facing globally. But then we've got this challenge here that a winery and collectively all the wineries make actually a very, very small contribution to that. I guess picking up on your analogy, Zhao, about the canary in the coal mine, I'm just wondering if it's inevitable that we will collectively have to tackle all of our carbon emissions in one shape or form. Is carbon in the wine industry, although it might not be globally significant, is it an indicator, an opportunity for the wine industry to show leadership, or at the very least show willing, show movement in the right direction? So whereas financially it's hard to justify, is there a case to be made that we should be doing something?
Well, yet again, I guess, because I would challenge anybody to find me another industry, and not even agro, but industry, that has such a level of organization as the wine industry worldwide, such a level of commitment, such a level of investment, such a level of ahead of the curve, such a level of investment, such a level of investigation. There is none There is none. You cannot find me another industry that has per country, God knows how many sustainability programs. Look at the US. Just the US alone has like, what, 5-6 sustainability programs just for the wine industry? Then Portugal now has 2, Italy has 2, 3 actually, Australia has 1, Chile, South Africa. I mean, what else can we do? Regenerative agriculture. We're in the edge of what has to be done. Packaging, dematerialization. We're again in the end. We're reference. We're literally reference for everybody else. If anything, we're leading by example. If anything, and again, but as I said in my initial intervention, we are the ones in the forefront also of the problem. We're the ones getting the problem right in our face. And so I think mostly we should, and bear in mind, there's another thing, if I might add, the wine industry is also probably the only agro industry with more millionaires per hectare, okay? You don't see millionaires buying potato fields or tomato fields, okay?
That's important.
In my opinion, that's important in another aspect, which is the capacity to influence decision makers. Okay. And the fact of the matter is the big problem we have currently in the world, it's a problem. This climate change issue is a defining generation problem. It's a survival problem. This is far more worse than COVID. This is not about winemaking. This is about survival of a species as we know it. And so when we have an industry that has all of these people, which are A, committed, B, have the capacity to, and C, have the access, and this is the most important part, access to influences, and I'm not talking about Instagram, I'm talking about political influences, EU, US Senate, whatever. It needs to be done. These people need to start talking about it. And they start to be saying, look, I have all of this investment made that probably in 20 years, if nothing really changes, it's going to be burned. End of story. Or I'm going to have to change totally my plantation with new varieties, and I'm going to have to re-educate my consumer because Chardonnay is not going to make it anymore. Or Pinot in Bordeaux, it's not going to cut it. Trust me, it won't. And so more than, I think we are by already a leading industry. Make no mistake, and we're not leading since yesterday. We've been leading since 20, 25 years. And so, and again, as you said, James, very well, carbon is indeed in the agenda and climate change is in the agenda, but carbon is in the agenda because of the carbon emitters, not of the carbon sequesters, okay, or not because of the carbon victims, which is what we ultimately are, this industry.
So there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity for the wine industry there to play the sequestration card. Good. Thanks for your points there, Zhao. I just want to cut to a question that's come in from Joanna regarding the theme of CO2. How important are partnerships with universities and investigation centres? So if anyone has had an experience with looking at innovation, looking at partnerships with universities, et cetera, academic institutes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Roger Bolton was one of the first people to build a prototype at UC Davis for carbon dioxide capture. The fizzy water that I talked to you about came from the University of the Czech Republic. If you talk to Dr. Richard Smart, who's now a retired professor, he has fantasies of flying over Fresno and measuring the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to shame the whole region into collecting its CO2. So now the professors, especially the engineering professors, are very excited about this subject.
Excellent. And on the previous panel, we had Deep Planet AI, and I think they probably would be very interested in that concept as well, Diana, given that they're remote sensing. We have come to the end of the session. I'd like to thank you all for participating. Really appreciate your time and your passion and input into this area.